them in the dark as much as possible. So is the administrator a hereditary position, or is it a committee? How do they stay trained from one generation to the next? There was silence for several seconds. Jeez, Bob, I thought you knew. The administrator isn't a Quinlan. It's an artificial intelligence. What the? I seemed to be getting a lot of metaphorical gut punches lately, and I quelled an urge to stand up and scream invective into the air. Suddenly, the Skippies had a motive. Bender, I have to phone Bill back in a few. Without waiting for a response, I composed a text. It would be easier to just lay it out and let Bill absorb that before responding. I fired off the message. Sorry about that. This is kind of important news. I had to let Bill know. Wait, when will he get the message? Is he in this system? I laughed. Instantaneous FTL communication, buddy. One of many things you'll have to get used to. Wow, that sure puts a different spin on the universe. At that moment, I got a response from Bill. Explains a lot, altering strategies as appropriate. So, I could probably get Bender back to our entrance location. I could probably do it without alerting Hugh. This was good. On the other hand, Hugh, oh shit. Guppy, has Hugh interacted with the equipment in any way?
Hugh has given instructions for construction and deployment of stealth drones.
No other interactions?
None.
Well, that was good. Guppy, monitor all communications with Hugh. Disallow control of local maintenance or infrastructure systems, especially roamers. Confirm all orders from him with me before implementing.
Acknowledged.
If Hugh had already subverted Guppy in some way, I was probably hooped, but I couldn't see how he could alter firmware without some board swapping and a full system restart. So for the moment, I would continue to act as if I was in control. And there would be an audit in my future. And I couldn't just stop interacting with Hugh. He was in charge of the local observation drones and was the only other Bob who was in a position to run one of the Quinlan Mannies. I would just have to be careful about what I asked of him. Bob, you still there? Oh, I guess I'd gone radio silent for a few moments. Sorry, Bender, just got a response from Bill, and now things are way more complicated. Not your problem, though, right now. Do you know how to get to the train station? Nope, sorry. I do know there's one in this complex, though.
In the complex?
So I could have skipped Halep's ending entirely? Well, it made sense, although I wasn't sure what destination I would have asked for. In any case, I wasn't going to just grab Bender and start running around at random. I guess I'd have to let the spiders finish mapping. 6 hours later, and there wasn't anything even vaguely resembling a transit station. Ideas, Bender?
Sorry, Bob, I was offline when they brought me in. It could be any number of levels down.
Oh, hell, I said, interrupting Bender. I forgot about the elevator. I guess you took the stairs or you wouldn't be here. I frowned. How so?
Cameras on the elevators. The people on site will know the moment an elevator is in use.
Can they override the elevators?
No, but they'll be alerted, and we'll be waiting when the doors open.
Great. So stairs all the way.
Bender, I don't like this.
I'm going to have to spend a god-awful amount of time just looking around to find our escape route with all the risk of being seen.
I got nothing, Bob. Sorry.
Okay. Do you have any more info on the trains, how often they run, whether calling one will alert the resistance, stuff like that? Bender sighed.
Sorry, Bob, no info. I'm not trying to be difficult. Like I said, I was offline.
Going with my theory that Quinlans and humans designed things generally the same, I went all the way to the bottom level first. Nope. Turned out that's where they kept all the pipes and valves and conduits, which, it occurred to me, was probably the same as with human construction. Derp. The next level up was a hit, though. A single, long, antiseptic hallway very similar to the transit station near Halep's Ending led to the boarding area with its 10 doors. In this boarding area, though, there was a prominent button attached to the wall, clearly jury-rigged, with wires leading into a hole.
That had probably been added by the resistance and probably bypassed the card readers, perhaps to allow people without cards to use the train. Ideally, I should press the button now and have a train ready when I came back down with Bender, but did it alert the people upstairs when pressed? If so, I'd never get anywhere near Bender's location. Like it or not, I was going to have to commit to a strategy based on nothing but gut feelings. I couldn't risk trying the call button now. I would have to take my chances and get back here with Bender before testing the system. Now, could I get Bender's matrix from his room to here without anyone noticing? I headed back to Bender's room, making sure to check for any Quinlans taking an unscheduled stroll. As soon as I was assured the coast was still clear, I recalled all my fleas and spiders. I wouldn't get another chance to restock from the underwater manis, so I was going to be especially careful with this set. I sat down in front of Bender. Good news, buddy, I found the train station. Bad news? We've still got a lot of unknowns and risk. I don't think we have a choice. Honestly, Bob, I don't see myself staying sane if I'm stuck here forever. Even frame jacking can only delay the inevitable. I think I'd rather go out in a dramatic chase scene, you know? I chuckled in response. Okay, so I'm just going to deactivate you, grab you, and run downstairs to the train station. How's that sound? What it lacks in elegance, it makes up for with wads of unearned optimism. Let's do it. I walked over to the matrix, put my finger to the power button, and paused. And Bender, if this all goes to hell, I'm glad I found you. Me too, buddy. See you in the next life. I pressed the button and Bender powered down. The latches released smoothly and I had his matrix under my arm. The replicant matrix wasn't a bunch of exposed circuitry, even in its first iteration back on Earth. There was a case of sorts, and even the connection bus had a flip-off cover, but like a hard drive from the good old days, if you put it in your backpack and smacked it on walls and dropped it on the floor, you could expect problems, so no backpack ride. The current iteration was a cube, about 8 inches on a side. Not too bulky, but pretty heavy. A Quinlan or a human would need to use both hands to carry it. Feeling a rush of unearned optimism, I shifted the cube for comfort, turned the corner, and ran right into a Quinlan. Unbelievable. This twerp must have left the committee room right behind the spider that had been on surveillance. Why was he here? Maybe he'd intended to talk to Bender about something. We stared at each other in shock for a frozen eternity. Then, just as his eyes moved toward the matrix under my arm, I punched him in the solar plexus. That is really becoming a habit, I thought to myself. The Quinlan said, oof, and sank slowly to the floor, trying to draw a breath. Thank the universe for convergent physiology. At least he couldn't yell out a warning. Then, from up the hall, Matthew, you okay? Oh, for crying out loud. I'd never get the second trank gun. I had a trank gun. I pulled it out of the pouch on the side of my backpack, leveled it at the second Quinlan who was just coming into view, and dropped him. Then I pointed down at my first victim. I hoped the close range wouldn't create a problem, and put one into his butt. Amazingly, he found just enough breath to shriek in pain and very probably mortification. Matthew? Jeff? What? Oh, great balls of fire. I was just riling them up more. Time to make tracks. Fortunately, they weren't between me and the stairs, but I had to come into view to get there. As I turned the next corner and sprinted down the hall, I could hear cries of alarm behind me. Well, Bender, you wanted a chase scene. Wish granted. I hit the stairway door at speed and sprinted down the steps, taking them three at a time. Quite a feat for a Quinlan. My pursuers wouldn't be able to match that. As I passed the second level down, I heard them come through the door above me. A quick calculation indicated I wouldn't be able to get the door closed quickly enough to throw them off, which meant it would be a straight chase to the train platform. I was faster, pound for pound, but they would be able to run on all fours, not being burdened with a replicant matrix. In retrospect, maybe the backpack idea wasn't so bad. I hit the train floor, pushed through the stairway door, and made for the platform with every erg of power I could squeeze out of the internal power systems. I calculated I'd have about 30 seconds lead time when I got there. Sure hoped a train was waiting. There were yells behind me as my pursuers piled out of the stairwell, and a ping-tinkle as a tranquilizer flechette skipped a few times along the floor near me. Way out of range, but I shouldn't be surprised they'd try. I hoped Bender's case was strong enough to stop one of those things, just in case it came down to a shootout. And speaking of, I had no idea how many shots I had left. You know, things never got like this when I used to write software. I made it to the call button and jabbed it frantically, though if the design was anything like a human elevator button, this would just slow down the train's arrival, and nothing was going to convince me otherwise. The sounds of galloping Quinlans drifted down the long antiseptic corridor. My 30 seconds were almost up. I turned, drew my trank gun, and shot the lead Quinlan just as he came into range. He went down with a yelp and skidded to a stop on his face. The others hit the brakes and backpedaled frantically. Then two of them went up on hind legs and pulled guns of their own. Just as I was steeling myself for a toe-to-toe shootout, there was a ding behind me and the sound of a door opening. I turned and jumped through the door, looking around for a button, a control panel, anything. A female voice said, "Destination." Oh, great. Halep's ending. There was another ding, and the door began sliding closed, just as a flechette flew in and struck me in the arm. Ow, son of a bitch!
Is medical assistance required?
No, let's go, please.
Please have a seat. Acceleration will begin in 8 seconds, said the train.
Eep. I plunked myself on the nearest seat, placed Bender on my lap, and examined the wound. Small, neat hole, penetration about a half inch. It was actually a nicely tuned weapon. Internal systems were already breaking down the flechette and starting repairs. There were no windows in the tube train, a view of a tube not being particularly inspiring, but it meant I wasn't able to see my pursuers as I pulled away from the station. I imagine they'd call a train as well, but could they follow this one? Could they ask the train attendant to let them off at the same platform? Train voice, can I specify a destination to be the same as the train in front of us?
There is no train in front of us.
I examined the ceiling briefly. Can occupants of a train behind us ask to be let off at the same station as us without specifying it by name?
Yes.
Shit.
I do not understand that command.
Never mind, thank you. How far behind us will the next train arrive?
It will arrive at the same location, not behind us.
How many seconds after our arrival will the next train arrive?
There is a mandated interval of 112 seconds between train departures and the next arrival.
Oh, much better. Thank you. No more questions. So, I had just a shade under 2 minutes, that being the human translation of the Quinlan time unit, VEC, to get out of Dodge or implement whatever strategy I came up with. I'd asked to go to Halep's Ending in a panic, but really I wanted to go to Garrick's Spine. But if I asked to go there, would they have a welcoming committee waiting? We'd already seen more than enough evidence that the Resistance's communications were efficient and far-reaching. Could I pull a fast one? Train voice, can I change my destination choice before we arrive?
Yes, but it may still be necessary to stop at the original destination first, depending on traffic.
Can we leave without opening the doors?
Not if passengers are waiting.
Are passengers waiting?
Yes.
Uh-oh. Those would either be Resistance or, less likely, crew. Neither group was likely to welcome me with open arms. Well, yes, they would, but not for hugs. I was going to have to put on some serious speed, which meant that Bender would have to go in the backpack. I just hoped that A, the matrix would fit, and B, I could tighten it down enough to prevent damage from jostling. A frantic minute of fooling with the backpack resulted in a partial success. I was able to fit Bender in and tighten the straps, but I had to abandon most of the contents to make space and to prevent them banging around. So, goodbye, flechette gun, extra knives, money. In a moment of inspiration, I swallowed some coins. My artificial stomach could be turned off, preserving the coins intact, but I didn't want to swallow too many and end up jingling when I moved. The train began deceleration phase, and I looked around frantically. Train voice, which door will be closest to one or the other edge of the platform?
The door 3 to your left or the door 6 to your right?
I dashed to my left, dropped to all fours, and went into a sprinter's crouch. I had to hope I could clear the vestibule before they could get everyone over to my end. The train pulled smoothly to a stop and the doors swooshed open. I immediately gave it all the gas I could, framejacking just enough to be able to evaluate the situation. I immediately evaluated that there were 4 Quinlans standing right in front of the door holding a net. I changed direction slightly and barreled into one of the net holders, knocking him over backward. I launched off his forehead and galloped down the hallway. A quick glance backward, rolling my eyes instead of turning my head, revealed that there were enough Quinlans to cover all 10 doors. That was a lot of personnel to bring to bear on very little notice. Where did they come from? That was a question for another time, a much calmer time filled with cups of coffee and purring cats. For now, I needed to amscray. I hit the emergency staircase door and began nearly flying up the stairs. I had to hope they wouldn't be cover. 2 flechettes hit me before I could react. Damn it! The gun-toting Quinlans stood in front of me, their eyes slowly getting wider as they realized that I was approaching way too fast and I wasn't slowing down. By this point, I'd pretty much perfected the run-them-down maneuver, and I didn't even break stride. I noticed on the way past that the second one had his security card dangling from an attachment point on his backpack. I gave it a quick tug, and with my already considerable momentum, it came off cleanly. Chances were he'd notice and report the card, but it was just a distraction. I still had Natasha's card, and they probably hadn't yet associated it with me. At the top of the stairs, I stopped and changed my features to that of the card holder, or at least as close as I could manage in a few seconds and without a selfie. Then I pushed open the emergency door. 3 Quinlans stood on guard, pistols in hand. One said to me,
"Rick, what's up?"
I bent over, put my hands on my thighs, faked deep heaving breaths, and tried to gasp a lot.
"Got him," pant, pant. "Need help,"
gasp, pant.
"Too strong,"
and I waved in the direction of the stairs while keeping my head down so they couldn't see my face clearly. Apparently my acting chops were pretty good as the trio headed for the stairs, barely glancing at me. As soon as they were out of sight, I went out the maintenance door and made for the wilderness. The good news was that I was free of my pursuers. The bad news was that I was stuck in the Halep's Ending area. They were obviously monitoring the train stations and would probably maintain a guard on them for the foreseeable future. They couldn't cover 400 million stations, of course, but they didn't need to. Without the trains, I was limited to what I could reach on foot or by water, and not even the latter since I couldn't take a chance on getting Bender's matrix wet. The backpack was under considerable strain with the cube stuffed into it. 1 popped seam, and that would be it. I could possibly book passage on a boat, but they didn't have passenger lines as such. You paid for deck space on a cargo vessel, and you fed yourself by fishing when hungry. Someone would eventually notice that I wasn't going in the water, and questions would be asked. Plus, there would probably be a bolo out for a Quinlan with a large, lumpy backpack. I needed to stop reacting and form some kind of plan. I found a field of tall grass and waded in a few yards, then plunked myself down. A little back and forth with my butt, and I had a nice nest, out of view of anyone happening by. Then I made a call. "Hey, Hugh?"
"Hi, Bob. What's up?"
"Things are very interesting right now. Listen, can you arrange a scan of the area around Halep's Ending?"
"Sure. Where is Halep's Ending?"
"It's near my location."
"Sure. Where are you?"
"I'm near..." "Never mind, I guess I didn't think that through."
"Sorry, Bob, still not enough equipment in the air to do random scans."
"Got it, thanks anyway." That was mildly embarrassing. I suspected I was still suffering from a bit of panic mode. I needed to slow down, calm down, take stock. I gazed up at the fake blue sky filled with real clouds and the occasional flock of birds. Lying there in a field of grass, it would be easy to lose the moment, to imagine myself back in Minnesota on one of those bluebird summer days. except for the large mountains and the stays holding up the central cylinder. That kind of blew the illusion. The stays. Will's professor friend had said they were used to access the central cylinder. Four stays, corresponding to the four rivers, ran up from the mountains. If I was to get onto one of the other rivers, the resistance's search radius would become untenable. But could I? Would Natasha's card have access to the elevators up to the central cylinder? Bender had said that he'd spent the last 100 years giving the resistance hacked access. And why stop with the trains or maintenance complexes? It was that or skulk around the area until they gave up, or try to get somewhere overland, or take a possibly even bigger chance on a boat. Screw it. I'd already gotten into the underground maintenance complex once and escaped. I doubted they'd expect me to go back there first thing. I sent a quick email to Will asking him for any details on the location and accessibility of the transport system up the cylinder stays, then set off yet again for the mountains. At least I knew the way. I peered through the bushes and glared at the single guard standing in front of the maintenance complex access door, trying to burn out his brain with my heat vision. Sadly, no heat vision. The guard stood relaxed, unaware of his brush with death. I could attack him and knock him out, but would he stay out long enough for me to get in and get to the elevator? And what about surveillance cameras? I hadn't found any around the entrance before, but they'd be on full alert now, and they'd only leave a single guard if that guard was being watched. Come on, Bob. James Bond could handle this. I could dig my way into the corridor, but that would take forever and would probably be noticed. I could kill the guard. No, not really. Knocking him out was contraindicated. Bribery was unlikely to work, even if I had something to offer. Distraction? Throw a rock over there, then wait until he investigated? Nah, too cliche for words. He'd probably turn in the opposite direction, expecting an attack. At that moment, a file arrived from Will. I put it on my heads-up and examined the images. It was a SUDAR scan from a segment boundary showing the area at the base of the stay, with inked-in annotations in a non-Bob hand. Probably the professor, but the important thing was that there was just enough detail for me to be able to find the complex's entrance to the transport system up the stays. If I could get in. And if all the segment boundary complexes were identical. I was stymied for the moment, so I might as well do something. I settled for searching for any cameras. Out came the spiders. I also wanted to be ready to move at a moment's notice if an opportunity presented itself, so out came the fleas to infest the door mechanism again. And I moved as close to the door as I could get while remaining hidden. It took very little time to find the camera. Hidden in some foliage, it had been set up to point at the guard's back. So the guard was as much bait as anything. They expected him to be attacked. Nice. And speaking of the guard, he seemed to be getting restless. Over several minutes, he glanced around, paced a bit, and scratched himself a few times. I hadn't done anything, so I wasn't sure what was... Oh. Hydraulic pressure, leading to a call of nature. The guard had moseyed over to a nearby bush and was, holy moly, what was I doing color commentary for? The guard had moved away from the entrance, and he had his back to it. I ordered the fleas to unlock the door, and as quietly as I could, I pulled it and slipped in. A couple of my spiders scurried in behind me, but most of them were left outside, along with most of my fleas. I could wait for them to dig their way in, but while I was doing that, the guard's shift could end, and his replacement could come traipsing up the corridor. Ungood for sure. Nope. I'd have to leave them and hope I didn't come to regret that. This part of the infiltration was almost routine, including the stair door that I'd previously jimmied. I went down one floor, which Will's plans indicated would lead me to the elevator up to the central cylinder. If there were security cameras, I would just have to hope that I looked enough like Natasha to fool them. and then I'd find out how good a hacking job Bender had been doing.
13. Getting busy. Herschel, July 2334, Bellerophon.
I got a ping from Will and replied with an invitation. He popped in within a mil. It had been, what, almost a century since Will had been aboard, even if only in Vert? I'd long since gotten tired of playing with Vert layouts and had reverted to the default library motif. Will barely glanced around. Hi, Herschel. Thanks for having me over. Hey, Will. Long time no see. I hope this isn't going to be as dramatic as the last time. He snorted. No. No intergalactic battles pending, that I know of anyway, just the usual dull roar whenever humans are involved. I gestured to a chair and called Jeeves. He showed up with a coffee for me and a Coke for Will. You know, your general dislike for humans seems incompatible with the amount of effort you're putting into Valhalla. Will paused to drink his Coke, taking long enough that it was probably a delaying tactic. Honestly, Herschel, it's simply my version of Ragnarok. If things had gone just a bit different back in Epsilon Eridani, I might have been the one to stay there and start a skunk works instead of Bill. I regret that sometimes. Dealing with humans has soured me a bit. Okay, a lot. I nodded slowly, trying to keep my eyebrows from climbing my head. Will was not usually this forthright. Something was up. Okay, you have a solution? Yes. Something I've been working on for a while, the Ever Onward Society, which I understand you've been sniffing around. At least that's what my sources tell me, and you've been fairly public about looking for colony volunteers. I think we've been working in parallel on very similar plans, to the point where the urge to scream copyright infringement is almost overpowering. I raised a finger and opened my mouth to respond before I realized I was about to argue copyright law. Instead, I smiled at Will. Okay, you got me reacting. Now give. Going off on a tangent for a moment, you guys have published enough analyses of the Bellerophon so that we could replicate it if we wanted to, except with a working surge drive instead of plates. I started building a slightly smaller version about 50 years ago. I goggled at him. In the 82 Eridani system? And no one noticed? That's a lot of material. He grinned in reply. Well, first, I've been very active with this Valhalla thing, and it takes a lot of effort and material to build all those fractionators and so on. And the colonies have mostly been concentrating on planet-side improvements, so it's not like we're getting in each other's way. Besides, the standard agreement between Bobs and colonies allows us to harvest such materials as may be necessary for activities relating to our original purpose, without compensation to the colony. I just never mentioned the side project. Wow, that's lawyerish. And it's still a lot of steel. The standard agreement doesn't set any limits on how much we can take. It's never really come up. I rubbed my eyes and checked metadata. Yep, definitely will. Okay, this is a little mind-boggling, especially coming from you, but I still don't see the connection to us. A couple of things, Herschel. First, your goal appears to be to place a colony far from current human space with no attempt to maintain communications. I get why you want to do that, but I don't think the part about severing communications is necessary. Second, your idea of sending AMI heaven vessels ahead of you is a kludge forced on you by having a bunch of colonists in your belly. Even the original project designers on Earth were reluctant to trust AMIs with that level of executive control. Except China, of course, and look how that ended. Will paused, and I tilted my head and gave him the side eye. Okay. What I intend to do is spit out ready-made space stations as I pass by systems. The stations decelerate to place themselves in a solar orbit, and we'll have drones on board to do a system survey. AMIs can handle that. And in the event there turns out to be something at all interesting, the stations will include a blank replicant matrix, just ready for a Bob to download into and take over. And if not, we still have an AMI-controlled relay station at every system along my flight path. I nodded slowly. Bob seeds, and you never have to slow down. But again, why tell us? If I lead and you follow, Will replied, then you'll know when I find a good colony target well before you reach that point, and once you've established a colony there, you'll still have a full hold of material, so from that point on, you can do what you were originally planning. Or do it your way. Will shrugged. Sure, whatever. Why, Will? What's with this urge to head for the edge of the universe? Because this sounds like the same kind of thing Phineas and the others have been doing. And you and Neil, what's your motivation for this? I'm concerned about running into someone or something that can wipe out humanity. We found a lot of intelligent races for the small segment of the galaxy that we've explored. It's only a matter of time until we run into something we can't handle. Will nodded. No disagreement, Hirsch, but don't you find it curious that all the civilizations we've found are or were at about the same age, give or take a few hundred to a few thousand years? No K2s or He-Chi or anything at that level. Don't you wonder why that is? Not necessarily. The local stars are all of similar type, similar age, with similar metallicity. There's really only a billion year or so window when life can develop, so I know where you're going, but I'm talking about a window of a few thousand years. That's a lot more coincidental and nothing more advanced out to as far as we can see. The Dyson Dilemma? Will, there's a simple solution to that. With Casimir power sources, civilizations don't have to cluster around their suns, except the others who had a biological imperative. Yeah, but still. Nothing. You don't think we're at the pinnacle of knowledge, do you? I laughed. No, of course not. But it's a pyramid by necessity. The most advanced civilizations at the top will be the smallest group. Not good enough. Will shook his head. At least I don't think so. There's something more at play. But there's no conflict, Hirsch. Your motivation and mine are compatible. Either way, we both want to get humanity more spread out. And while it's laudable that you're going to found a colony or two on the way out, this is still very much a one-way trip for you too, isn't it? Look, I can't speak for Phineas or Ick and Day or any of the other Bobs, but for me, the problem is that I can't shake myself loose. You know why I'm still our rep in the UFS? I laughed. Because everyone knows if no one else volunteers, you'll keep doing it. Will chuckled a little ruefully. I didn't think it was that obvious, but yes, I have this outsized sense of duty. It's my replicative drift, I guess, but they can't expect me to continue to carry it if I'm not around. Wow. I shook my head and thought for a moment. To be honest, I'm coming around to the idea that this maybe isn't some kind of sinister urge taking us over. Bob One was looking forward to the adventure when he left Sol that first time. I distinctly remember the feeling. Maybe this is what we've all always wanted, but have gotten distracted out of. Not all of us. I doubt you could get Howard to budge, or the gamers, or Bill for that matter. Yes? They found something else to dedicate themselves to. Original Bob had a strong sense of responsibility as well. You're not that far removed in that way, Will. But in the absence of anything to tie us to one spot, I guess there's a little wanderlust still in all of us. I agree, Will replied. But I don't think it's strictly either or. Guilt can do funny things to people. I nodded. We settled into a mutual silence for a few mils, although I couldn't decide if it was the awkward or companionable variety. Neil popped in at that moment. Will! Long time no see! Come to inspect our research? Will looked surprised, and I controlled the urge to roll my eyes. I couldn't suppress a low growl, though. Research? I waved a hand in dismissal. Well, we do have this large ship full of raw material and a lot of time on our hands. I hadn't heard anything. We haven't been posting any papers, I said. Neither of us is quite sure why. The best we can come up with is that we're not sure if we want this stuff to be public yet. Oh, now you've really got me curious, Will said. I shot Neil a glare, which he studiously ignored. We'd appreciate it if you'd keep it quiet until we feel ready to do a reveal. I sent Will a guest Manny address, then closed my vert session and entered my personal Manny. I pulled myself out of the Manny pod. Beside me, Neil was just sitting up. On the other side of him, Will was peering over the edge of the guest Manny's pod. "This is the Bellerophon's control cavern," I said to Will, gesturing around us. "You've pressurized it?" he replied. "Just the control cavern. The rest of the ship is still in vacuum. We have to use the airlock if we want to go anywhere else, but that's a minor inconvenience." I lifted off from the pod and hovered a few feet away. Will's eyebrows rose on his head. You appear to be flying in control." I grinned at him. "These Mannies have small surge drives, based on the mover plate technology. Very small. Good for maybe a tenth G and not sustainable over planetary distances, at least not yet, but they're perfect for moving around in freefall." I demonstrated by doing a few loops, then returning to my original position. Will grinned, then got that slightly distracted look Manny operators get when they're concentrating on internal systems. Then he shot out of his pod with a whoop, did some barrel rolls, and swooped over to us. "How is this something you'd be reluctant to share? This is awesome!" Neil replied before I could. "This isn't what we're talking about, Will. This is a minor item we implemented for convenience on the Bellerophon. Until we get the surge power up a lot higher, it's not useful for anything but free-fall maneuvering. And I can't think of any situation where Mannies are used right now where this would be useful. Except here, of course." "I bet every Bob in existence would want to turn, though," Will said, still slowly doing loops. "But okay, let's see what you consider to be more than a minor item." I gestured him to follow and headed over to a corner of the cavern where we'd set up our workshop. Walls, cables, pillars, and stanchions had been welded to the deck in whatever random location we'd needed them at the time. Looking at it through fresh eyes, I felt a twinge of embarrassment. It did look somewhat haphazard. But Will didn't seem to mind. He headed, unerringly, for the structure that dominated the work area. It vaguely resembled an oversized Manny pod, but with a lot of science fiction-ish greebles tacked on. I did a quick mental inventory to check if any of those were actually gratuitous. Will would probably ask. He stopped, hovering in front of the pod. "This is impressive. I have no freaking clue what it is, but I like it already." I cocked my head at Neil. "You want to do the honors, or should I?" "You had it last time," he replied. "My turn." I gave Neil a pro forma eye roll, then gestured for him to get on with it. "I'll hold your Manny," I said, and grabbed his arm just as his Manny went slack. Will looked from one of us to the other, perplexed. "He's gone back to vert?" Why, he was interrupted by a door opening on the giant pod. Will floated back several feet as our experimental Manny stepped out and hovered in place. I gestured to it. "This is the X-Man 1. Stands for Experimental Mannequin 1. Neil is running it right now." Will's expression was slack with amazement as he examined it. The size and shape were consistent with our standard Bob Mannies, but the X-Man 1 was a mottled silver-gray color. It wore no clothes and had no particular gender. Neil did an exaggerated bow, then slowly rotated in place, grinning the whole while. "So what do you call it?" Will asked. "Instead of X-Man 1, I mean." Neil and I exchanged a glance. Will looked back and forth at us, noting our no-doubt shame-faced expressions. "Okay, guys, give. You can't tell me you haven't come up with a nickname." I responded with a sickly smile. "Mannequin Skywalker." Will stared at me for several mils before responding. "You're despicable." He flew over and examined the Manny at close range. "The skin, surface, whatever, it seems to be, moving? It's a little unsettling, to tell the truth." "This Manny," I replied, "is made up entirely of ants, or our adaptation of the ants, to be more precise. We've managed to miniaturize them to about the size of a tardigrade. They link up, kind of like actual cells, and can form any shape we program into them." I grimaced. "We haven't quite got the fine control nailed yet, though. Neil's skin actually is crawling." Will made a face of exaggerated disgust. Man, I can see someone getting a phobia just being near that thing. For that reason alone, I'd approve of not making it public. The thing is, Will, I said, this design can shapeshift. Not quickly yet, but we'll keep improving it. There's no built-in discrete structure as such. Every ant unit is capable of doing any required task by reconfiguring itself. Everything from the SCUT transceiver to the surge drive is built from cooperating units. Skeletal structures are generated by units locking themselves together with double bonds, and so on. The computer core is distributed throughout the structure, as is the power core. There is no Achilles heel, no weak spot. That's a lot of power for a post-human replicant. Will nodded. Yeah, I get it. Look, when you feel like it's ready for a real demo, let's have the senior Bobs look it over and maybe make a recommendation. Sounds good. I looked at Neil and tilted my head. He nodded and climbed back into the pod. Will shook his head in wonderment. Wow. This beats Transformers and Space Whales hands down. 14. Getting out. Bob, July 2334, Heaven's River. I don't know what I would have done if I'd run into a security patrol. I no longer had a flechette gun, and needing to be careful about Bender's Matrix meant most of my go-to tactics were unavailable. Fortunately, the subject didn't come up. It was quite possible that all personnel were outside looking for me around the Halep's Ending transit station. I stared at the elevator. It didn't really look that different from any other. Maybe a little larger door. The problem was the button, or more accurately, the sign over the button that said Authorized Personnel Only. There was a card reader beside the button. I took a totally unnecessary deep breath and pulled out Natasha's card. Moment of truth. I doubted that a failure would result in sirens and flashing red lights, but it would certainly alert someone, and I'd have visitors by, and nowhere to run. Before I could kvetch any more, I pushed the card against the reader, then pressed the button. The button lit for a moment, and the door opened. Hallelujah, I was in business. I entered the elevator and pressed the top button, since that would be where I'd transfer to another stay. The doors closed, and the elevator accelerated upward, and I realized something that I'd failed to notice when I boarded. This elevator had windows. I shouldn't have been surprised. The Quinlans had long since shown that they had a strong visual artistic sense. Naturally, they wouldn't waste the opportunity to display this view. I had 56 miles of vertical travel in which to enjoy it, and, I didn't specifically remember ever having had acrophobia, but I'd never been going literally miles up into the air with a panoramic view before. I had to consciously stop myself from stepping to the back of the elevator. If this got any worse, I might have to activate the endocrine control system. I deliberately stood at the window and observed while trying to control my breathing. The curve of Heaven's River was becoming visible, and we'd already passed at least one cloud layer. The river system, forests, townships, and dots on the water that could be boats all spread out below me in a panorama that exceeded anything I'd seen in a lifetime several hundred subjective years long. I made a point of recording as much as I could and forwarding it to my blog. The trip took 20 minutes total, which was quite impressive. Deceleration was accompanied by an automated suggestion to place my feet on the ceiling, as the centrifugal gravity by that point was almost non-existent. When the doors opened, I was in as close to zero G as made no difference. The corridor had a visible curve, with doors and side corridors spaced regularly along it. The sign beside the elevator said, Utopia spoke. Handy. I just needed to move over to the other east flowing river, the Nirvana. I picked a random direction and headed off. As with my first day when we broke into Heaven's River, the Quinlan body had no trouble adapting to zero-G movement. Handholds along the corridor helped as well. Within a few minutes, I'd found the Nirvana spoke elevator. Small problem, the elevator was at ground level, so there would be a 20-minute wait. The ride down was very much like the ride up in reverse. Strangely, starting from a view from orbit kind of panorama made it easier to get used to the height without cringing. By the time it started to resemble real land, I was verging on bored. This maintenance complex was uninhabited, which led me to believe that most of the population of the mountains was probably resistance. I made it to the train station without incident and pressed my card against the reader plate.
"Not authorized,"
I looked up sharply. "What?"
"Your identification is not authorized."
Oh, great. They'd canceled my card. Well, Natasha's card. It had been inevitable, but couldn't they have done it after I'd gotten on the train? I fished out the second card, the one I'd grabbed from the guard, and tried it.
"Not authorized."
Well, that was that. I looked around, half expecting the entire population of hell to come pouring out, but this complex was uninhabited. Come to think of it, I'd never seen or heard of the administrator using anything but live muscle inside Heaven's River. Maybe automated muscle was forbidden. It sounded like the kind of limitation you'd place on an AI to keep it from taking over. And how had that worked out for the Quinlans? Still, while I wasn't about to be tackled, I also wasn't about to get a free ride back to Garak's spine. And hordes of minions could be on their way right now. Their cards would work. A hasty departure seemed advisable. Back up the hallway, up the stairs, and soon I was in the lobby. The maintenance door opened easily from the inside, and I was out in the open. I could see a town in the distance, but I had no idea what it might be called. I was a quarter turn around the circumference of Heaven's River and 3,800 miles west of Garak's spine, which was my only way out. I had an 8-inch cube in my backpack, sticking up like a carbuncle and advertising my presence to any crew or resistance who might be looking for me. I might as well be wearing a hard hat with a flashing red light. Oh, and I couldn't risk going in the water. Piece of cake. I needed a story, some plausible reason for the big lump in my backpack. A quick glance up at the sun confirmed the day was young. I had plenty of time to get to the town before dark, but maybe I shouldn't. I had only the coins in my stomach, and I might need them for something more critical than lodging. I dithered for a few moments, then decided I might as well head for town while I tried to come up with something. First, I'd need to update Hugh. "Hi, Hugh."
"Bob, got news?"
"Of a sort. I have Bender."
"That's great. I'll meet you at Garak's spine and we can get out of here."
It may not be that simple. I updated Hugh on recent events and my current location.
"Well, that's suboptimal," he said. "Listen, you can't be the first Quinlan that's needed to carry something large. A funerary box is about the same size, for instance."
What?
"Bridget can probably give you anthropological details, but Quinlans keep the bones of their deceased. Ground up, they fit into a box of about the right size."
"You'd accumulate a lot of boxes over time," I commented.
"Yeah, I don't know. Ask Bridget. But maybe check around town. Someone might have something that would keep the box dry. Maybe you can find a funerary box and test it out."
"That's an excellent idea, Hugh. Thanks."
"Then you just need to travel 7 segments to Garak and you're golden. Thanks a bunch, Hugh. And with that cheery thought, I'm signing off."
Still, one problem at a time. I paused and prairie dogged to get a close look at the town. Things might be looking up the slightest, teeniest bit. I composed and fired off an email to Bridget, not wanting to spare the cycles for a conversation. I'd review whatever she sent me when I had time. The first order of business, though, was to not come into town along the road from the maintenance complex. If someone was watching for a Quinlan with a carbuncle, that would be the obvious place to set up. Moving through the bushes was more of a pain than expected. I remembered Bridget mentioning that the climate varied from segment to segment, probably to replicate conditions on Quin. This segment had a more tropical motif, which meant thicker and more riotous vegetation, and probably a lot more variety in the way of predators. and me without so much as a pig sticker in my inventory. After a half hour of bushwhacking, accompanied by my best cursing, I decided enough was enough. I spied a trail ahead that likely led to a regular road and made for it. The path led through some pretty run-down residential structures, and I began to worry about being mugged. A couple of rough-looking characters did give me the evil eye, but no one made a move. In 15 minutes more, I was in the town proper, which was named Forest Hill. I buttonholed a few random strangers and eventually got directions to a funeral home. The Quinlan translation was more like House of Setting Sun, which was oddly poetic for a culture that named cities after people's body parts. I entered the establishment and glanced around. An elderly Quinlan came over to me.
"May I be of service?"
I'm concerned about getting my grandfather waterlogged. I'm not sure exactly what might be available.
"Are you transporting your ancestor over a large distance?"
"Yes, to Garrick's Spine."
"I'm not familiar with that city. However, the normal strategy is to have the ancestor sent by post, carrying the box on your back."
The sales critter ostentatiously leaned sideways to look disapprovingly at my backpack. I felt like I should blush or something. "I'm hoping to bring him home myself. I'd like instead to find a way to wrap the box or get a better backpack." I left the sentence hanging, hoping the sales critter would volunteer something. He glanced at my backpack again, then asked,
"What size of funerary box?"
Bender's matrix was 8 inches on a side. "Inside dimensions, 8¼ inches, I said, trusting the translation software to take care of the conversion to local units.
"That's oddly precise. Also not standard size. Here."
He wrote something on a piece of paper and handed it to me.
"My cousin, Vinny, is a carpenter. He could probably put something together to your specifications. Tell him Carmine sent you."
Of course, this wasn't a mass production society. Artisans would be easily available. I resisted the urge to smack myself and thanked Carmine profusely. I left the funeral home, chuckling at the software's choice of name equivalents. I'd have to ask Hugh if there'd been a little tweaking of the algorithms. Given what I'd done with Hugh's name equivalent, it was clearly Bob-like behavior. I read the note while wondering if I should ditch the backpack and cube while I worked. I could hide it in the forest, or I could get a room in a hotel. What would carry less risk? The forest would certainly be cheaper, but I couldn't bring myself to seriously consider tying Bender up in a tree and leaving him to the tender mercies of random chance. I did a quick calculation. I wasn't destitute yet, but I might end up working for passage on the way back to Garrick's Spine. Meanwhile, keeping Bender safe was job one. I stopped at a general store and bought a few small items for 3 coppers total. I gave the proprietor an iron and received my change. I had a brief urge to swallow the coins right in front of her, but attracting attention was not a good idea. With a little searching around, I found a fleabag hotel and paid for a night. The kindest word I could find for the room was unimpressive. But it had a door lock, and the door felt solid, and the window was much too small for a Quinlan to get through, even if the room had been at ground level. And as was typical for Quinlan structures, the roof was exposed, support beams and all. I took out the length of rope that I'd purchased and did a quick leap and parkour to the rafters. It wouldn't be, strictly speaking, impossible for a Quinlan to duplicate that feat, but they would be more likely to just go get a ladder, which would hopefully take time. I tied the backpack with Bender in it to the highest point and shifted it around to be as invisible as possible from floor level. All good. I left my one remaining spider on the rafter as well, just in case. The Quinlan door locks were large and clunky compared to what I'd been used to on Earth, but the mechanism was nevertheless fairly sophisticated. Again,
I was reminded that the Quinlan's technology was limited, not their knowledge. I spit up a few coins to carry with me, locked the door behind me, and sent in a couple of fleas to freeze the lock mechanism. I was probably being overly paranoid, but the downside of overdoing it was much less bad than the downside of under-preparing. First stop was a backpack shop. On Earth, that would have been a sports store, but with Quinlan's, backpacks were simply apparel. A few quick inquiries on the street, and I had a destination. The shop was definitely upscale, not as in gold trim, but as in high quality and good selection. They carried backpacks, sashes, kits for fur decoration, and other items that the sophisticated and stylish Quinlan couldn't live without. I just hoped the backpacks were more than fashion statements. I approached the single sales critter. "I'm looking for a new backpack. My old one popped a seam because I've been carrying a funerary box in it. Do you have something with good capacity and dependable waterproofing?"
"As it happens, we do. You shouldn't, of course, spend a lot of time in water, but it'll hold for the occasional fishing expedition."
He led me over to a display and gestured.
"Only 5 irons for this model."
Eep. That would take most of my remaining cash. I opened my hand and looked down at the 4 irons I'd coughed up, trying to project disappointment, piteousness, and whatever else I could manage. He glanced at the coins in my hand and sighed.
"I can't do 4, my friend. 4.5, and it's yours."
"No problem, sir. I'll just hack, hack, hack." No, not really. The urge was almost overpowering, but even ignoring not wanting to attract attention, I was sure he'd throw me out. I'll talk to my friends back in a while. I left the shop and went looking for Vinny's place. On the way, I surreptitiously coughed up some more coins. Vinny's place had a sign over the door that said, "Vinny's Place." Really, Quinlan's sucked with names. The window showed some of his products, including funerary boxes, small furniture, and some carved items. He did good work. "Are you Vinny?" I said to the lone occupant as I walked in.
"I am. May I help you?"
"Carmine sent me here. I'm looking for a specific size of funerary box. He thought you might be able to help me." Vinny's face lit up, and I realized that Carmine must actually be a relative and well-liked. I hoped that would help my cause. We spent a few minutes talking about my requirements.
"It's an odd size and oddly specific," he said.
"I'm trying to protect my existing box," I explained. "My grandfather died a long way from our family home. I have to bring him back there, and I can't afford the obvious methods."
"I admire your dedication, young sir. I can produce such an item. It will take about 3 days and will cost 6 irons. However, I can't guarantee that it will be watertight. That simply isn't normally part of my requirements."
"Well, between the room, the backpack, and the box, I'd be wiped out, and I would still have to pay for passage. And I didn't have any choice about going by boat. While the Manny would probably survive a 7-segment swim, I very much doubted that Bender would arrive still dry. Like it or not, I was going to have to play tourist. Or deckhand. But I had no choice in the end. We talked some more, and I considered trying to haggle him down, but the simple lack of waterproofing rendered it moot. In the end, I thanked him for his time and told him I'd think about it. I was heading back to the backpack store when I received an alert from the spider in my room. Someone seemed to be trying to unlock the door, and they were being increasingly unsubtle about it. The fleas had rigged the lock well enough that the interlopers would have to break down the door to get in. Would they go that far? Would anyone notice or investigate? It wasn't a high-class neighborhood, but the proprietor might object to costly damage in a room that would be unrentable for a while. And the would-be home invaders agreed. After a few more rattles, the sounds of assault stopped. I had no illusions that was the end of it. It appeared none of my plans for the day were going to succeed. I changed direction and picked up speed, not quite breaking into a run. As I moved, I stretched my features and changed my fur patterns back into Natasha's face. That might get me in the door without being observed. The door to my room was still intact, although the lock and knob was a little more scarred than I remembered. No one appeared to be hanging around. I didn't kid myself, though. There would be surveillance. Whether they were looking for Bob, or Natasha, or both, was an unknown. Whether it was crew, resistance, or both was pretty much irrelevant at this point. My fate at the hands of either party, and more important, Bender's fate, was a foregone conclusion. I glanced at the window speculatively as I was climbing up to my pack. No such luck. What had originally seemed like a security feature was now a trap. There was only one way out of this room. But not necessarily so for the building. They'd be watching the front and back doors, but maybe there was a third alternative. I collected my spider and fleas, then locked and re-jammed the door. The scam probably wouldn't distract my pursuers for long, but every little bit helped. Meanwhile, I needed to be out of here. I headed for one of the two second-floor bathrooms for some privacy and a chance to think. How to get out undetected. I couldn't just go downstairs and peek out the front door without attracting attention. I had accepted it as a given that someone was watching the front, probably the back as well, and there were only the two doors. From the bathroom window, I could see the alley where one of the pub staff was tossing something into the dumpster. I snorted. Dumpsters. Another parallel. Wait. What other parallels were there? Food deliveries. Garbage pickup. Even a dump like this needed services supplied by other companies. I took a quick glance out into the hallway. No one. I made my way to the back of the building where presumably the kitchen and storage areas would be. On the way, I passed a cleaning person with a cart. The cart included a garbage can of sorts made of wood. No trash bags here. The cleaner was working on one of the rooms, so I grabbed the can off the cart. As I continued down, I placed my backpack in the can, then hoisted it up so the contents weren't visible. I got a glance or two as I passed through the service area, but who's going to question someone who's obviously working? Chances were the hired help around here was transient and part-time anyway. I made it out to the back, holding the can up so it obscured my face and making a show of struggling with the weight. The dumpster was up against a fence, something I'd noticed from the bathroom. What wasn't discernible was whether the fence would collapse the moment I put my weight on it, but it didn't matter. I was committed. I swung the can around, still projecting, "This is really heavy, y'all," with every pour, and upended it onto the edge of the dumpster. As I tipped it, I grabbed the backpack before it could drop into the bin. I pulled the can back with one hand, put it upside down on the ground as quietly and quickly as possible, and used it to vault over the fence. There was a shout behind me and I could hear running feet, but I was already on the other side and out of sight. I had perhaps 2 seconds to get out of view of someone coming over the fence. A quick glance said that west was the shorter sprint to cover. I went east. As I turned into another alley, I heard the thump of someone landing, and a curse. Did I mention that Quinlans weren't particularly acrobatic? Smiling to myself, I imagined a couple of sprained ankles. That would slow them down. Meanwhile, though, best make tracks. I dodged and wove through alleyways and quieter streets, avoiding any area with too many potential witnesses. Within minutes, I was at the edge of town. Without breaking stride, I headed for the forest. Sleeping in a tree. Not a phrase a Quinlan was likely to use, which made it ideal for me. I found a particularly large, heavily foliaged specimen and set myself high up in the thicker parts. I spit out my spider for sentry duty, clamped my arms around the trunk, and ordered the AMI to stay put. Everything seemed stable for the moment, so I exited the Manny and popped into my VR. Hugh, I'm invert if you feel like popping over.
Sorry, Bob. Stacking cargo. I'll try to get away later, though.
Honestly,
I wasn't sure what I would say to him anyway. Did I want to confront Hugh about the administrator thing? What would I accuse him of, exactly? I didn't even know for sure that he was aware the administrator was an AI, and if he did, say he admitted to suspecting it, what law or rule exactly had he broken? My suspicions were second order, I realized. Suspicions of suspicions. I would have to keep a lid on it until I figured out what, if any, nefarious motives Hugh or the Skippies might have. I tried connecting to Gandalf, but got an auto-reply. Probably Gandalf was fighting orcs or something. Quickly, I checked Bill, Will, Bridget, and Howard and got either busy signals or auto-replies. It appeared everyone in the Bobiverse was a little tied up at the moment. With a bad-tempered grumble, I called up a coffee and activated Spike. So, item. I had 7 segments to traverse, and it would have to be mostly by boat. Come to think of it, even if I trusted the Quinlan postal system to deliver Bender safely, it wouldn't be any faster. The mail traveled by boat. Item next. I still had to get out of Heaven's River once I got to Garrick's spine. In principle, that shouldn't be an issue. We had the side entrance hatch that Gandalf had built. On the other hand, the locals were much more aware of us now, of me particularly. As Will's professor friend had rightly pointed out, I was probably going to show up on a lot of surveillance systems from now on. I could disguise myself, but I couldn't disguise the backpack. Or couldn't I? Granted, I had to watch my money, but my biggest hurdle right now was to get out of Forest Hill. Once I could lose myself in the vastness of Heaven's River, I might be okay. So, how to get out of town without exposing Bender's matrix to view? 15. Frustrations mount. Howard, July 2334, Trantor. Well, that tears it, I said. Humans are idiots. Bridget sighed.
Given what's going on, Howard, I think they've shown considerable restraint in grandfathering us.
Or they've noticed that we own half the damned city and they'd lose a proxy fight.
That may have played a part, I admit.
Bridget walked to the picture window and gazed out, arms crossed. I enjoyed the panoramic view of the atmosphere of Big Top through the distant Fibrex dome of the city. The sight of clouds and Jovian life stretching off in all directions, seemingly to infinity, never failed to fill me with awe. But I knew that for Bridget it was about more than the view. It was